The first topic is the halachic seder, a Yerusha, intested distributions under the halacha that's going to be given by Rabbi Avraham Gutman. The moderator for this segment is Baruch Greenwald, who's with Greenwald Weiss, and they have offices located in Brooklyn and in Lakewood, and they focus on estate-related matters. So I'll ask Mr. Baruch Greenwald to come up and introduce the topic.
Good morning, everybody. First of all, thank you to Rav Chaim Cohen, Ari Marburger, the Business Halacha Institute, for inviting us here to moderate today's session. I'm happy to introduce Rav Gutman on this interesting topic. I figured we'll just introduce it by bringing up a couple of scenarios where intestacy would apply and explain under New York law and New Jersey law how things would be handled. And we'll first just introduce the basic terminology, again, assuming not everyone, that possibly everyone here is familiar with the terminology relating to estates and intestacy, but we'll introduce it that way. And I thought it was actually relating to this week, and you know, Parshas Vayishlach starts out with Yaakov and Esav, and Yaakov coming in and basically saying, "I didn't receive what sort of I was supposed to receive under the bracha." So, starting out with siblings and Yerusha aspects, whether there was a will or not in that case, whether the brachas maybe constituted a will, whether verbally is a will or not, in halacha we'll allow Rav Ram to talk about that. But as far as intestacy, what that means is that testate means when someone passes away or dies with a will, and the will would control how his or her assets are distributed. Intestate refers to someone who dies without a will, and then the governing law of the jurisdiction, you know, in this case, being that we're in New York, but a lot of us have a connection to New Jersey, and our firm in particular deals with, New York and New Jersey. So we'll just talk about how New York and New Jersey would handle intestate matters. And then there's something called probate assets, which are governed by a will or the governing instrument. And non-probate or will substitute assets are assets that would pass in some other way, like joint property, beneficiary designations, and things of that nature. And in that case, really, whether it's intestate or testate, the non-probate titling of the assets would really govern how those assets would pass under law, and the intestacy would only be governed by secular law, in this case New York and New Jersey law, as to who the distributees are under law. And the distributees are the people who are the heirs under law if there is no will, again, when someone dies intestate. So I just thought to illustrate it, that maybe the best way would be by giving a couple of examples and scenarios where someone passes away intestate. So we'll just use a nice Jewish name today. I just picked the name. Mr. and Mrs. Klein are married. They're married for the first time. And they have three sons and one daughter. And neither of them got around to preparing a will. And in this case, Mr. Klein predeceases Mrs. Klein and is survived by his wife and their three sons and one daughter. So each of them had Neither of them had been previously married. So in New York, this would be a case where everything would be distributed 50% and 50%, with the surviving spouse receiving 50% of the estate and the surviving children equally receiving the other 50%, except what is a $50,000 amount off the top that goes to the surviving spouse. But for simplicity, it's basically 50-50. In New Jersey, on the other hand, all of the assets would actually be distributed to the surviving spouse. So there's a major difference in terms of how that would be handled. You have a case where basically you could have a spouse who's young and passes away leaving a widow, and 50% of the assets would be going to perhaps even young children if there's no will in place, which may not be the intended result in this type of case. So obviously having a document where someone would say this is how it should go could be and might be really preferred in this type of scenario. You know, how halacha would handle that, again, I'm not going to touch on that at all. We'll leave that to the halachic authority. Then you have another scenario where the same Mr. and Mrs. Klein, but Mrs. Klein predeceases Mr. Klein. And in this case, it would be handled exactly the same way for state purposes, but for halachic purposes, it would actually be handled very different, possibly, and we'll leave that again. One other scenario, I'm going to make it very fast, is if, again, the same couple, they have children all the same gender. Again, that's going to be the same thing under New York and New Jersey law, as we said before, 50-50 under New York law and 100% to the spouse under New Jersey law. Again, there will be a different type of halachic scenario, possibly. And then you have a scenario where Mr. and Mrs. Klein have no children, where in a case like that, you really could have a really strange scenario where the spouse, if the spouse survives, again, under New York and New Jersey law, it would be exactly the same. But again, just bringing about how halacha would work, I'm bringing up some of these points just to show how different things could be in terms of halacha and how you really could have a result if things aren't titled properly or left properly, where it could be handled the way people wouldn't want it to be. The last thing is where they were previously married, Mr. and Mrs. Klein, they each had descendants or children from a previous marriage, and they're on a second marriage. Mr. Klein predeceases Mrs. Klein, and in that case, if there's no will, intestacy under New York law would actually be the same, but New Jersey would actually switch it in this case, where instead of 100% going to the surviving spouse, it would go 50-50 to the surviving spouse, so very similar to New York law, and then to the children of the deceased spouse's previous children that he had from a prior marriage. And just to end off, one big thing that comes out of all this, obviously, is that assets may not go exactly how someone wants, but also you could have major tax issues that come up where someone leaves something to people where there may be a tax result where if it's going to a spouse, there's a unlimited marital deduction for things left for assets left to a spouse. Obviously, a qualified disclaimer could take care of that, but someone would have to know to do that. And therefore, they could lose a very important deferral of estate taxes if that's important, as well as other items that can come up for very important purposes in terms of even elective share issues that can come up. But I think my time is up, and I think it was up 2 minutes, 3 minutes ago, but here's further ado, and I'll remind you of the scenarios when we're done if you want to discuss it further. Rabbi Gutman, we'll take questions and answers afterwards.
Thank you, Mr. Greenwald. Again, we're going to be discussing today what happens to a person's belongings, his estate, upon his demise, in the event that he did not make any form of will, any form of tzavo, any form of estate planning. Most people that I know have a difficult time getting their brain around the fact that they're not here forever. People have a hard time dealing with their own mortality. And because of that, they push off writing a will, making a tzavo, and things of this nature. And because of that, it often comes out that their property, a person, theoretically speaking, could distribute his estate in almost any form or fashion that he pleases, as Rabbi Marburger will elaborate upon. But if he doesn't do it, then the nechasim, his properties, will be distributed according to the dictates of the Torah, At least that's how they're supposed to be dictated, supposed to be distributed, in the absence of a tzava, in the absence of a will. Now, the first thing that we need to understand is we're going to be discussing three possible forms of Yerusha. One is the general Yerusha, the general inheritance to the immediate family. The second section we're going to be focusing on is what happens in the event when there's a Bechor. The Torah stipulates that a firstborn male receives a double portion together with his other brothers. And finally, we're going to be discussing the concept of marital property, or property that belonged to the husband, property that belonged to the wife. What happens upon their demise? Does it go to the children? Does it go to the spouse? And in what form, etc.? So the first thing is, what you need to understand is, in the absence of any form of will or tzava, the sons, the male children, will inherit all of the property and not the daughters. So there's one son and five daughters. The one son will get the entire Yerusha, the daughter will get nothing. In the event that there's multiple sons, the sons will divide that property. In the event that there are daughters and there are no sons, then the daughters inherit the property. One gets one. If there's many, they'll divide it evenly. This Yerusha goes, now in the event that one of those, let's say the sons, let's say the demise, he has a son, and that son predeceased him. He died already. But that son had children, whether they're male or female. So we view those children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren as taking the place of their grandfather, who was the male son of the demised. In which case, for our purposes, if you understand what I'm saying, if I didn't confuse you yet from my verbiage, that means as follows. You have a man, we shall call him William. I don't know if we're going to refer to him again, but William dies. Now when William dies, he left over a daughter, and he left over two sons. Now, that three children, a son, a daughter, and two sons. One of those sons was predeceased him, so there's a daughter, a son, and a granddaughter from a son. There were two sons, one of them died, he has a daughter, so now we have a daughter, a son, and a granddaughter. So the property will be divided in half. Half going to the son, and half going to the granddaughter. Because the granddaughter, since she's an offspring of the son, she takes the place of her father, and thereby, the property is divided half to the son, half to the granddaughter, whereas the daughter would be left out in the cold, as it were. Now, in the event that there is no children, and there are no offspring from the children, that means the man died without any direct descendants. So then it goes back up to his father, assuming his father's alive. The father would take his demised son's property in the event that the father is no longer living. So we then branch out to the father's children. And if the father has any other children, which would mean the deceased's brothers, so it would then go to the deceased's brothers, going through the father to the brothers. In the event that there are no brothers and or brothers' children or grandchildren, again, if it will go up to the brother and the brother is already deceased, it will go to his children in the same fashion that we described, going to the males, giving the males preference over the females. If there would be only females, that would go to the females. In the event that the deceased has no brothers, it would then go to his sisters, because technically what it was doing is, it was going to the deceased father, and from the father to his son, no sons, or descendants, it then goes to the deceased's father's daughters, which would mean the sister of the deceased. Okay, so what's happening is, and then again, in the event that the deceased has no children, and his father has no other children, it would then go to the deceased's grandfather, right? The father's father. And then, so forth and so on. If the grandfather's not alive, it would go to the grandfather's sons, if there are sons, or descendants of the sons. If there are no sons, and no descendants thereof, it would then go to the daughters of the grandfather, and to their descendants thereof. And that's the way it goes back, until we go all the way back to Yaakov Avinu, where we, at some point, there's got to be, you look around the room, there has to be descendants. So we're going to assume that at some point the Yerusha will be divided according to the dictates of the Torah. Now, we said that the sons or the daughters, as the case may be, will be dividing the Yerusha evenly. And this is true whether the deceased is a man or the deceased is a lady. That means if their father dies, we divide the Yerusha amongst the sons or the daughters in that case. And if the mother dies, again, the property is divided between the sons. And if there are no sons or their descendants, it's divided amongst the daughters or their descendants. Now, there is one point that needs to be, before we end off on the basic Yerusha section, is that very often it comes out in the event of a person dying without a will, and the property is going to be divided by the state, and the state has a seder, who gets what? And very often there's going to be, the state doesn't recognize the difference between males and females, and thereby the daughters have legal, from a legal standpoint, they have a claim again towards the estate. In order for the sons to receive their portion, very often, depending on the locale, it would require the daughters to sign off the documents that they agree to the dispersion of the estate. In the event that their signature is required for the sons to get anything, they don't have to give their signature for free. They have the right to sell, as it were, their signature for whatever they feel is appropriate. And, you know, this is open for negotiations, depending if the daughters are better negotiators than the sons, then they'll end up with a goodly portion of the Yerusha. In the event that the sons are a better negotiator, or their lawyers thereof, so then the sons will end up with a better portion. But technically speaking, we cannot compel, at least that's the agreement of the majority, the preponderance of the Paiskim, we cannot compel the daughters just to sign off on their legal rights, in spite of the fact that halachically they do not have a portion, technically, conceivably. Now, moving on to the second portion of our discussion, this is something which is highly misunderstood, perhaps almost as misunderstood as the distribution of the estate as far as spouses are concerned. And that is the bechor, the concept of a firstborn male son. Now, generally speaking, the Torah says that if you have a firstborn male son, he inherits his father, pishnayim, he gets a double portion. And the Torah says, b'chol asher yimotzeloi, which means, for all of those assets which are found by him, or which are considered at hand. In contradistinction to property, which we shall call, just for the use of the words, we're going to call it accounts receivable. But those are very imprecise terms. The Gemara refers to two concepts. One is called muchzik, which means in possession, and the other one is called ro'oi, which means things that he's supposed to get. So, I want to first, before I focus in on what's considered muchzik and what's considered ro'oi, what's considered something at hand and something that's considered an account receivable, I want to give out, tell you a few points that have to be clarified. The first thing, the basic concept is, let's say a man dies and he has four sons, leaving the daughters out of this. He has four sons. One of them is a firstborn male. So then, we would divide the Yerusha, we would divide the inheritance into five equal portions. And the firstborn male would be receiving two of those portions. And the remaining four sons, the remaining three sons, would then each get one more equal share. Now, this concept of pishnayim, of a double portion, only applies when you're inheriting your father. If somebody inherits their mother, there is no pishnayim. So, regardless of the fact that he's the Bukhar, he's the firstborn male, it doesn't make a difference. From the mother, from the father, it makes absolutely no difference. Since the mother is the one, let's say the father predeceases the mother, and because of a will, all of the property, all of his assets went to the mother. And now the mother dies, her Yerusha is then divided amongst the sons evenly. There is no din of Pishnayim, there will be no double portion going to the Bukhar. Number one. Number two, it has to be that the Bechor was born, the firstborn male was born prior to the death of his father. Now you can say, well, how could he be the firstborn of Bechor if the father died before him? In the event that there were multiples, twins were born, triplets were born. So even though one of them is a Bechor, he had to have been alive before his father died to be considered a Bechor. Now the third thing, which is like a very big chiddush, is that if the Bechor was born through cesarean, he does not get pishnayim. He had to be born not with heroics, he had to be born with a regular birth. The next thing is that, let's say, a child is born after a previous child, and that previous child went full term, full 9 months, and lived and then died, the child coming after him is not considered a Bechor. Even though he died a day after his birth, he's not considered a Bechor because, as long as the previous child was full term. And finally, what needs to know is that the Chelek Bechorah, the Chelek of getting Pishnayim double, does apply even though the Bechor predeceased his father. He died before his father. Nonetheless, if he has children, those children, the grandchildren of the deceased, will be dividing the double portion of their father, the Bechor. Now, what, as I promised you, what is considered muhsik, what's considered assets on hand, and what's considered assets that are not on hand? So, tangible property, we all could agree, is considered muhsik. For example, if he has a silver menorah, or he has cash in his pocket, or he has a house, or any other sort of tangible property, this is clearly considered muhsik, is clearly considered assets which will be divided, which are subject to the halacha of Pishnayim getting a double portion. The question arises, what about in a situation where the Gemara says three examples which are considered ro'i, or assets which are accounts receivable. One of them is an inheritance which the father did not receive from those who are moirish him. That means in the event that his father died. A man dies, and he has a son who's a Bukhar. But his grandfather is still alive. And then his grandfather dies. And those properties go from the grandfather to the deceased son, to the son who predeceased him. So his grandson, the Bukhar, does not receive Pishnayim in those assets, because that's considered roi. That wasn't property that he had at the time of his death. It was property which he received post-mortem after he was already dead. And therefore, there's no Pishnayim in any assets which are received via Rusha by the mace. In addition, the Gemara tells us that if somebody collects a debt after he's dead, technically, accounts receivable, if somebody owes someone money, Reuven is owed whatever amount of money, and it was not collected when he was alive, so even though it's collected after he's dead, there is no din of Pishnayim on those assets. Now that's going to cause us a tremendous amount of befuddlement, as we'll see in a moment. The exception to that is in the event if I have a tangible security on that loan. For example, he owes me $10,000, and he gave me his wife's diamond ring as a security. So we don't view it that debt is ro'oi, it's only accounts receivable, but we view it, it's already in his pocket because he, theoretically speaking, he has a physical control or ability to collect that debt. Also, if he has a mortgage on a property, but if that's merely a mortgage on a property, but let's say that property he's physically in possession of, again, we don't consider that loan to be considered ro'i, only accounts receivable. We consider it actually in his pocket, and therefore the Bechor would take a double portion. And the final, Gemara gives another example, in the event where a man dies, and he left over assets which produce profits, left over a field, and it's producing profits. Prior to the division or the apportionment of the Yerusha, which means the field or the asset is still in a state, it wasn't divided amongst the heirs, so any profits which that estate will produce after the demise of the mace, we still consider that roi, we don't consider that muhsik, it wasn't in the father's possession at the time he died, because the property produced it after his death. And thereby, we say that there's no din of Pishnayim on those three type of assets. Now, this raises many, many questions, which some of them is what I shall call settled halachic law, and many of them are not settled. What I mean by that is, depending on which of the Gedolei HaPoskim you're going to look in, you're going to look in the Achronim, and they are marich, there are many forms of assets which didn't even exist in the time of the Gemara, stocks and bonds and things of this nature. So to define whether they're considered muhsuk or ro'oi, this is going to be a matter of halachic debate and halachic dispute, and until this very day, it's not settled law. So, bank accounts. If the father died and he had $100,000 sitting in a bank account, is this money considered muhsuk? is it considered in the father's possession or not? So, or is it considered roi? It's like a debt. The same way if I lend a person money. Conceptually, a bank account goes as follows. They take the money and they're allowed to spend it as they please. So one would argue, and there is a halachic argument to this effect, that this money is considered a loan to the bank. Since it's a loan to the bank, it's considered a halva, a loan. And the halacha of a loan is that even though it's collected the day after the man's demise, it's considered roi, it's considered fitting an accounts receivable, and there will not be, pishnayim, it will not be divided, the b'chor will not get an extra chelek, it will be divided evenly amongst the heirs. However, there is a halachic argument that since a bank account is payable upon demand, there's no, even though they don't have to have your dollar bill sitting there, you know, if I give you something, a deposit to watch, I give him my silver menorah to watch, even though it's in his house, it's considered a muhsik, because the person who's watching it is considered an agent for the actual owner. So in the case when the bank has an obligation to return the money upon demand, so there are those paiskim that hold, that the money in a bank is considered muhsik, it's considered under the control of the mace, and thereby there will be the halacha of pishnayim even on a bank account. Stocks and bonds. Tremendous machlokes ha-paiskim. The Aruch HaShulchan, when he describes government bonds, but the reason that the way he describes that they're considered muhsik, he says people carry on business with them every day. You could sell them, you could buy them, they're traded, and that would apply to stocks also. It's something which is constantly available. There's no, without any hesitation, there's an open market. When you collect a loan, maybe you'll collect it, maybe you won't collect it. When you're dealing with a stock or a bond which are traded on the open market, he says that's considered muhsik, and therefore a bechor will take pishnayim. He will get a double portion. Contrarily, the Pischei HaChoshen seems to assume, based on other sources, that when he's talking about stocks, he says there's nothing here, there's nothing tangible in front of you. You have on record certain amount of shares in a business. Unless you're the owner of the business, unless you're one of the primary owners, so what you have is nothing more than roi, and there would not be a din of pishnayim on these assets. Now, I'm a little bit going long on the distinction between roi and muhsik by a bechor, because really, it's not all, and say, well, how many bechorim are there out there? But the answer is, this distinction is going to be relevant when we get to the estate of a spouse. This distinction will also be relevant, that's why I'm beleaguering this point, the distinction between those assets which are considered in their domain and assets which are considered accounts receivable. Now, people who own copyrights or people who have a license to carry on certain businesses. So, again, it seems to be assumed by the Paiskim this is not considered, although it's an asset which is sellable, it's not nonetheless not considered muhsik, it's considered roi because it's a means by which to generate assets, with which to generate profits, and therefore it's not considered muhsik, it's not considered under his domain, and the Bechor would not get pishnayim on licenses and copyrights. Now, similar, not exactly the same, would be in the event a person owns a business, whether it's an LLC, whether it's a corporation, or whether it's just a private family business. So if it's a private family business which has a physical edifice, and that physical edifice, we shall assume, is what's generating the profits, one might argue that there would be a din of pishnayim, there would be a double portion, it's considered muhsik. However, when you're dealing with a service-based business, where, technically speaking, all I have is my name and the fact that I could generate profits because people come to me because I have this business. So, under those conditions, it's strongly argued that this is not considered muhsik. Such a business would be considered roi, considered accounts receivable, and the bechor, the firstborn, would not receive pishnayim on such assets. Now, just two more small, before I move on to the next section, and that is, what's in the event, God forbid, somebody dies under a in the event of an accident or under a workman's situation where he had a working accident, and there's working compensation paying the heirs for this person's untimely demise, or in the event of a car accident where the insurance company is paying. Now, the money that's being paid legally is being paid to the estate, and there is a certain formula with which the government would be, or the government, the overseers, but the insurance or the courts would be distributing that money. Would they be giving it to the spouse? They'd be giving it to the children. That money, does that money go into the Yerusha? In order for it to be considered an inheritance, halachically speaking, it had to have belonged to the person who died before his death. And that's counterintuitive, because he can't own it once he's dead, and when he's alive, he wasn't dead, so he wasn't eligible to death benefits. So thereby, there's a strong argument that this money which is being distributed would not be subject at all to the order of Yerusha, because he first received this money after he was dead, and thereby it would not be subject to Hilchas Yerusha altogether. There seems to be a ktsais which may disagree with this. It's talking about Dinei Neherag, if a person gets killed, God forbid, in the time of the Gemara speaks about the people who have to pay for the person who got killed. The ktsais considers it assets of the mace, and it would be distributed according to the order of Yerusha. It would not be mufsik. He certainly was not in possession of the money before he died, and thereby it would be divided evenly amongst the heirs. And finally, and the last point I would bring out, is life insurance beneficiaries would be considered, assuming that there are beneficiaries listed in the document, it would not be subject to Yerusha at all. Rather, whoever the person, this is a binding contract which the person who took out the policy made with the insurance company, that the money should be paid to various beneficiaries upon the demise of someone, and thereby that money would be distributed according to the dictates of the policy. The only exception, one might argue, is in the scenario of where the person who died was the legal owner of the policy, and let's say in the case of whole life, where there is a cash value to the policy before you get to the death benefit. There's a cash value that the person who owned the policy could cash out the policy for, so that cash value would again be considered eligible for Yerusha, that portion, and would then be divided evenly amongst the Yerusha. If the policy is payable to the estate, it's an excellent question, it would probably then be divided according to the dictates of Hilchas Yerusha. Okay? Now, one might go out on a limb, if you're, for example, a lawyer or a toyein, and you came into Beis Din, you say, well, it's payable to the estate, but when the insurance company said, we're paying it to the estate, we meant the estate according to the laws of the state of New Jersey, or to the estate according to the laws of the state of New York, whatever it should be. But from a pure halachic standpoint, payable to the estate means payable to the estate according to the laws of the Torah, how the Torah would divide the estate accordingly. Yes?
Would the same apply to a beneficiary designation on an IRA or even a joint account?
Oh, we're going to get to joint accounts. Okay, an IRA, we'll get there, I hope. A Bukhar would not get Pishnayim, even in the case that it would go to the estate, because again, it would not be Roy, it would only be Roy, it was not Mukhsik, he wasn't in possession of it prior to his demise. Yes, but even if it's a loan, we said the loan. There's two things. The loan aspect of the policy is roi. That's not muchzik. Right. We said loans are payable as roi. The beneficiaries who are listed in the policy, even though the person putting in the money is lending it to the company, but he said I'm lending it to the company, and the company should then pay it out to A, B, and C.
It wouldn't be subject to the rules of Yerusha. It would be subject to the
correct.
The
you mean the dollar amount also?
The dollar amount, yeah. If you have a contract with a bank that says I'm putting in $10,000,
absolutely, yeah, you're right. If the loan that I'm saying, if the cash value was one that would be paid out to the beneficiaries upon his death, you're 100% right. That would not be subject to Yerusha. 10 points. Now,
why would the whole life insurance be more mostly than an IRA?
It would be more ROI than an IRA.
I thought you said that whole life insurance.
No, I was distinguishing between a whole life and a term policy. Term policy where there's nothing more than the death benefit.
But still, whole life. I understood you to say that you would go quite well with Yerusha.
if there would be a cash value, except he has a halachic argument with me that was not the terms of the policy, and thereby it would be voided. Okay. Now, before we discuss the distribution of the assets of a spouse to the surviving spouse and to the other yorshim, we ought to clarify three points which are very, very important to know as general overview in life, not only as far as Hilchos Yerusha are concerned. The first thing is as follows. Very often, for whatever reason, we shall not discuss at length, very often there are assets which are put under somebody else's name. Whether they're being sheltered for tax purposes, whether they're being sheltered for lien purposes, whether they're being sheltered for whatever purposes, there is the actual owner, as it were, you know, what we would call the real owner, wink wink, between me and you, and the person who we are putting the assets under their name. Although legally the assets are considered, unless there's unless the courts decide that it's some form of collusion or some type of fraud going on, the courts will consider it the assets of the person who is listed as the asset owner. Halachically speaking, if everyone involved is in agreement that it was only put in their name for name purposes, for shelter purposes, so halachically speaking, we view the asset as belonging to the real owner, what we know as the real owner. That's the first thing you need to know. Whenever you're discussing, it'll be everything. Because who is the real owner of this asset? And the real owner of this asset, from a halachic standpoint, is the one who all the parties involved agree is the genuine owner. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be a fight about that. What was the intention of the parties? After the person's dead, and now we start arguing, well, he put it in my name, but he didn't really mean it. He put it in his name, but he didn't really mean it. He really meant to retain the asset. And the other one says, no, he really meant to give it to me. That's what, you know, that's how you make a living. But the point is that if, as far as defining the asset belongs to the person who we could agree, if we could agree, the intention of the genuine owner was. That's the first thing you need to know. The second thing is, in the event that an asset is owned by Reuven, and he nominates a beneficiary in the case of his death, right? So, if the person only becomes the owner upon his death, he's not an owner when he's alive, but he only becomes the owner upon his death, so, although it might be a matter of dispute, but Reb Moshe Feinstein clearly states that pretty clearly states that it's subject to the regular laws of Yerusha, because since at the time he was alive, it belonged to him, and it only belonged to the nominee upon his death, we have a halacha that you cannot give a gift after you're dead. Give a gift while you're alive, you cannot give a gift after you're dead. By the time he died, Hilchos Yerusha took over, and thereby the property goes to the Yarshim according to Seder Yerusha. The third thing, which is, again, I don't want to get shot up here, but there's a concept that's called tenancy by the entirety. When there's a home which is owned, for example, a home, doesn't have to be a home, but with rights of survivorship, where it belongs in its entirety to the husband and in its entirety to the wife. Right? Legally, there is such a concept. We view it as belonging to both of them. Neither one could put a lien on the property without the other one. Neither one can sell a share in the property without the other one. It's called tenancy by the entirety. And in that case, legally, there's a rights of survivorship whereby the ownership devolves to the ownership. When one person ceases to live, it automatically remains in the possession of the other spouse. So from a halachic standpoint, halacha does recognize this ownership. And thereby, in the case of a spousal home, which was purchased and named as joint ownership, not joint ownership, but with rights of survivorship between the husband and the spouse. So no matter who dies, the house remains in the property of the remaining spouse. Okay, so that's what we're going to say. There's a great mistake in that halacha, which we need to understand. A woman and a man could each own assets in spite of the fact that they're married. There is a halacha that, depending on the prenuptial agreement, that what a wife earns belongs to her husband, and in exchange for that, the husband is obligated to support his wife. So whatever she earns during the course of their marriage, it belongs to him. And at the same time, he has an obligation to support her. Now, technically speaking, she could walk into the marriage, or even during the marriage, she could say, you know what, you're good for something, and therefore, I'm going to support myself, and I'm not interested in you supporting me, and I'm going to support myself, and all my assets will belong to me. But assuming that she didn't do that at any point, so then yes, what she earns belongs to her husband. However, if she comes into the marriage with assets, or during the course of the marriage, she inherits assets, so those assets are hers. Okay, when they get married, or during the course of their marriage, they purchase a house, and the husband agrees that this asset should belong to her, so there is a strong halachic basis to say that the asset was purchased with the intention that it should belong to him and to her.
On the other hand, they even say that like the engagement ring, rings and stuff, even jewelry really belongs to the husband. And then in Lechadova, they give
so then he can't marry his wife, right?
No.
Because he has to give her the ring. And
no, I'm saying, they don't use that. The husbands don't use that. To, like, if the wife gives away something,
We can't go into all what everybody says under all conditions, but we're going to try to get to, no, we could perhaps discuss it later, but I want to get to the point. Now, a man could have assets which are distinct from his wife, and a wife could have assets which are distinct from her husband. Now, in the case of a divorce, Chalila, so then we say everybody walks away with their own assets. He brought in assets, he takes them with him. She brought in assets, she takes them with her, and move on with life. In the case of death, assuming that there's no prenuptial agreement, and again, it's not good enough to have a legal prenuptial agreement, it has to be done halachically correct in order that it should be crafted properly and in order that it should have halachic teeth, as it were. And there's no wills, and there's no tzava, and there's no other form of estate planning. So what happens is as follows. Let's say he dies first. He predeceases his wife. So then, all of the assets would go to the children, not to the wife. The spouse would not inherit. The spouse would not inherit, the wife would not inherit her husband. However, until such time that she remarries, or until such time that she demands her ksuva in Bezin, she comes to Bezin and she says, okay, I want you to pay me up my ksuva. Until that time, she has the right to stay in the family abode for the rest of her life. So if they're living in a very nice mansion and she wants to stay there, she can't. The Yarshim who now own it, they have absolutely nothing to do with it because she's stuck. She has the right to stay there as long as she pleases. And she is supported financially from the estate. And until such time that she either remarries or collects a ksuva, she basically is able to stay in the house and be supported from the estate. When she sees that the estate is dwindling, technically speaking, let's say they were living in an apartment they were renting, and there's no estate left, and it's dwindling down to the last few $1,000, she could say, okay, now I want my ksuva. In which case, basically, she received everything from the estate, and the children ended up with nothing, technically speaking. That's one possible scenario. In the event that she dies first, so then we then distinguish the assets between what's considered muhsik and what's considered roi. The husband only inherits those assets which are in which were in her physical possession at the time of her demise. So therefore, again, if there's her leichter, her silver candlesticks, or perhaps her if she had a house which was she inherited from her father and she owned it at the time of there, and then he dies. So yes, those assets will then go to the husband. But things which are debts or bank accounts or all those things which we discussed before, which are open for halachic dispute, whether they're considered roy or they're considered mochzik, those assets will then go to her children and not to her spouse. Now, one last point I'd like to. One last point I'd like to just bring out, and that is, although we've discussed pretty much a general idea of various forms of assets, there's one last form of asset that I'd like to just briefly touch upon, and that is reparations. In the event that somebody suffered from, let's say, the German government, or the Austrian government, or the Polish government, or whichever government that they're paying reparations now. And the person dies, and the government is still going to be paying those reparations after the demise of the person. Or let's say right now there's a lot of times that the governments are finally waking up. Okay, we're going to give back property in Poland, or they're not giving back property in Poland, or whatever it should be. So Do the halachic yarshim get those reparations and that compensation? Or do we say that that whoever files the forms is the one who's going to get the money? And although one could enlarge, as you know, a halachic argument in both directions, basically it would be assumed that since these reparations are being paid well after the concept called yiyush, the people who actually were owed the money were long miyayish, and they long gave up any possible hope of ever seeing any form of payment for these monies, and also a lot of the payments are just because the governments feel bad, and thereby, whoever would actually fill out the forms and those governments would then pay those monies to, they would be entitled to take the money, and they would not be subject to the general dinei Yerusha. Now, at this point, I used up my time, but could I take questions?
Questions. If anyone has questions, we'll fill them together. So if it relates to both of us, we'll share the answers. Or my question was, I said Klein and you said William. So the question was why the lawyer said Klein, and that was my first question. But anyway, okay.
Lagavi, the joint assets. If somebody Mechaim creates an account, it's clearly his intent, and there's some legal right that the joint owner has. So you mentioned Moshe Bensky says that as long as you don't get it until after 120. So does that affect a beneficiary designation also? That the din Yerusha would apply even for a beneficiary designation? And what would be the din Lagavi, a joint asset?
Okay. So, the way, a little bit unclear what you're asking, but I'm going to try to answer you from as best that I can. In the event it's a joint asset, in the classical term of a joint asset, legally I own half and you own half. Right? If there's no rights of survivorship. So if this, assuming there is a rights of survivorship, so then we might view as tenancy in the entirety, in which case they would get the entire asset. Okay, but if it's only a joint asset without rights of survivorship, so then we would say half is mine, half is yours, and in the event that one of them dies, they would then the half that belonged to me would then be divided amongst the yarshim. But in the event of rights of survivorship, I do believe we would view that as a joint tenancy in the entirety, and it would then devolve to the ownership of the remaining party. I believe so. You disagree?
Yeah.
Everybody owns everything. Okay, your joint tenancy, you don't own everything. You just get it. If they die, you get it, but you don't own the whole.
But if you don't own it, so I'm going to answer basically what I'm saying.
I just want to ask you one thing. You said you can't sell a tenancy by the entirety. You could sell a tenancy by the entirety, but when you sell the tenancy by the entirety, it becomes ice tenancy by the entirety. The wife and the husband can sell their share.
Really? Yeah. Okay, so I can't argue with a lawyer, although the law book that I read didn't say that, but I can't argue with a judge. So, but as far as your question, if it's not tenancy in the entirety, so then although there's rights of survivorship, it should be totally in rights of in Hilchos Yerusha, in which case it would not be. The fact that you said that rights of survivorship, that in itself would not rule the day.
He's talking about New York State, yeah.
Joint tenancy gives you a right, okay, when a person dies to receive it. However, if you take out more than your half, for instance,
right. You're
only entitled to your moiety, it's called. Right? So if you're receiving this money, you're not receiving it by death. Half of it is yours.
Right.
And I don't believe that half would go back into Hilchos Yerusha based on that, because you are actually the owner of half of that money. The fact that you inherit the other half, you may be subject to Hilchos Yerusha, but not the half.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I meant. That's what I meant to say. Okay. We're on the same page. Yes.
But the nice the decedent, the person while he was living, was his money entirely. He just wanted to circumvent the necessity for probate. So he made a chop. Would that be still regarded as something which doesn't follow the jury?
Okay, so that's what I told you to begin with. If the intention of the party, that was the first introduction to the section, was if the intention of the party is it's really mine, and I'm just putting somebody else's name on there, it's mine, and it's subject to Yerusha.